The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Live from the WGBB studios in Merrick, New York, this is Sports Talk New York.
Crossroads of Merrick Road and Sunrise Highway in beautiful Merrick, Long Island. This is WGBB Sports Talk, New York, 95.9, 1240 a.m. on your dial. 516-623-1240 is the number. 516-623-1240. I'm your host, Mike Wadone, joined as always by the man we call Cappy, Chris Caputo. Looking forward to a fun show tonight. Going to be joined very shortly by former Mets manager Mickey Callaway. Talk about his experience in managing on the big league level, what he's up to now. Dive in a little bit about maybe if he was in a situation that the Mets are in right now, what would you do? But before we do any of that, Cappy, welcome back to the program. I appreciate you pitch hitting for me full 2 weeks ago, and we're back in action.
Yeah, thanks for getting back in the studio with me. We did talk with Zach Scott last time about the trade deadline and a little bit with some of the prospects. And, you know, it was interesting to kind of break down as the trade deadline was happening and what moves people might make. And I think kind of puts teams in a situation where they are now. Some teams went for it and made a move and maybe have gone 9-1 in the last week and a half. And other teams kind of sat back and said, maybe we're just going to see what we have. And, you know, we'll get into that. But there's a lot of frustration in the New York area. Yankees, Mets, both are having a tough time over the last few months. And it really has not gotten much better in the last 2 weeks.
Yeah, from a talk show standpoint or even from a fan standpoint, you know, thank God there's some football on the horizon. But that can go stale pretty quickly as well. But still a lot of baseball to be played. You know, we're in early August, but it's definitely it's not looking good at the moment. And some things have got to change on both ends. But before we get a little deeper dive into that, we are very happy to be joined tonight by former Mets manager, former pitching coach, had an outstanding run with the Cleveland Indians. We're going to call them the Cleveland Indians because that was the name of the team at that point. But we're joined by Mickey Callaway. Mickey, Mike and Chris here in New York, how are you?
Hey, Mike and Chris, I'm doing well. How are you guys?
We are doing fantastic, and we're so happy to be joined by you tonight. It really, you know, we want to talk to you about your career, obviously, but just kind of get a little bit of a different perspective. You know, if with any baseball team kind of going through the things that we're seeing here in New York at the moment, but, you know, again, welcome to the program, and, you know, hope all is well. Quick question for you. Right now, you know, we're going to get into your career, but what are you doing baseball-wise at the moment? I believe you're working with some young pitchers?
Yes, I am. I'm actually working for I don't know if you guys recall Ed Easley. He caught in the big leagues a little bit for the St. Louis Cardinals, mm-hmm. and he has a baseball organization here in the Memphis area.
Okay.
And I'm kind of roving around to his older teams and helping out the coaches and players. And then I'm also doing some baseball pitching lessons on the side, and I'm really enjoying it. It's so good to work with these young kids and, you know, see them really make changes very quickly. So I'm blessed and loving life here.
So, Mickey, Chris here. I just wanted to ask you, when, you know, you tried to put yourself in a player's standpoint, and, you know, I know that didn't last for you too long in the major leagues, but I think that just shows how hard it is to make it to that level. What made you make the transition from a player to a coach, and how did that go for you?
Well, you know, I tried to play as long as I could, right? I always kind of knew, you know, it'd be difficult for me to really, really compete at the major league level just because my stuff, my fastball was a little short, my curveball didn't really have the bite that we liked. So I just kind of grinded out some years in the minor leagues and got, you know, a few years in the big league pitching. Not with great success, but I really enjoyed my time playing in the major leagues. So, you know, my goal really early on, probably halfway through my career, was, you know what, I want to be a coach, you know, at the major league level. So I just tried to play as long as I could, got as much experience overseas, you know, able to communicate with people from different countries, learning how it is to play in a different country, because when you're dealing with those guys that are coming over to the United States and they're not from here, it's a difficult thing, you know, and it doesn't matter how much money you're making. It's a difficult thing to be away from home and family and play in the big leagues. So that experience really was able to help me communicate with those players. And, you know, I really enjoyed my time playing for sure.
Well, I'm sure it's a big difference between, you know, Major League Baseball and when you went overseas, you went over to Asia to, you know, to play. But is it still kind of baseball is baseball no matter where you are in terms of playing professionally and just, you know, everyone's kind of focus and intensity on making it to the next level?
It really is. You know, everybody over in Korea, for the most part, they're trying to get over here. Everybody in Japan is playing and wanting to get over here, especially the foreigners that are trying to, you know, keep their careers up like I did going over to Asia and playing. So, but you know, what great experience over there. And, you know, it is baseball as usual. You know, the game is the game is the game, mm-hmm. no matter what country you're in. And, you know, I had, we had two foreigners on the team, me and another guy, and we had an interpreter, but you really didn't need one when you're working with the coaches, even though you didn't speak the same language. You know, it's baseball is kind of a universal language when it comes down to strategery and stuff like that.
So, Mickey, you caught on with the Indians prior to the 2013 season. You guys made the World Series in 2016. You had Corey Kluber there winning a Cy Young. You guys won 102 games in 2017. What is it about the Cleveland organization, you know, including yourself, that allows pitchers to succeed in that situation?
You know, we really tried to dot every I and cross every T when it came to preparation. You know, you have to stay healthy if you want to have a good season. We also really allowed our pitchers to embrace pitching deep into games at that point, which I think has kind of fallen by the wayside a little bit. So our starters hauled a lot of innings. I think we were up in the top, you know, two or three every year as far as innings pitched by starters. And I really think that formula worked. We had a great bullpen. But, you know, wherever you are, it's all about being blessed with good players, and we had great pitchers with Cleveland. We had a great run there for about 5 years, putting up some very impressive record-breaking numbers.
And it certainly seemed, you know, for the city of Cleveland, which always got, I think, kind of a bad rap, you know, in professional sports, and just I think it's a lovely city. Chris actually, you know, he spent some time working there. Just such a great time for Cleveland Indians and for the organization. And like you said, along those lines, I wanted to ask you. You worked, you know, under Terry Francona, and it just seems wherever he goes, he just seems to he wins. But you just hear great things about him. Can you talk a little bit about Terry and what it was like working under him and some of the things you took with you to your first managerial stop?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Terry is such a relaxed person on a daily basis that he kind of takes all of the pressure away from the players, right? He focuses on processes and stuff like that and understands that this is a very difficult game to play, and he has a lot of grace for the players when it comes to dealing with them. So that is definitely one thing I tried to take away is, look, hey, always protect the players. Make sure they know that you understand their frustrations because this is a difficult game. And that's probably one of the things that he did the most. On top of that, he's one of the most giving people that you'll ever be around, right? He really took care of the coaching staff and really helped educate us on baseball in general. You know, it wasn't just, okay, you guys do this and that. He really collaborated with everybody on the staff, and we would pick his brain. Because his knowledge of the game is next to no one. So he's just an all-around amazing leader and really laid back, you know. And I think those traits and those positive traits that he had, you know, really kept you from going into these negative, you know, spirals mm-hmm. that you see teams go in. Because yeah. You know, it can get a little hairy out there when things aren't going your way, and then you know, guys start kind of, you know, clubhouse, you kind of lose them a little bit and they start, you know, bickering at each other. But he really kept everything positive and laid back and stress-free.
So, Mickey, you started the 2018 season with the Mets. Can you talk a little bit about what it was like in the beginning? Because the Mets did start out 11-1 that year. You got rosters of like Kevin Plawecki and Austin Jackson, and you guys start out the season 11-1. What was it like in the beginning, you know, taking over for Terry Collins and leading that team to a good start?
Oh, it was really fun. You know, obviously it was my first spring training as a manager, and my goal was to get out of spring training and get clicking on the right note. You know, I think that manager's huge responsibility during an entire baseball season is managing spring training the right way so you can come into the season clicking on all cylinders, everybody's healthy, so you can get off to a nice start and kind of, you know, hand it over to the players as the season goes on. So, you know, I was really proud of the start we had both years I was there, but I really, really enjoyed that 11-1 start. Obviously, it was very exciting. You know, baseball in New York is like playoff baseball in Cleveland on a daily basis. So there's no better place to coach or manage or be around baseball than in New York. You know, obviously there's pressure to win on a nightly basis, which is something that you always want to be there. But it is the most electric playoff atmosphere baseball 162-game schedule I've ever been around, and I loved it.
Once again, we're joined by Mickey Callaway, former manager of the New York Mets, pitching coach extraordinaire with the Cleveland organization here on WGBB on Long Island. And, Mickey, along with that, you know, obviously Chris and I are both Met fans. It was a fantastic start, as you mentioned, your first year, 11-1 and out of the gate. And just that even early in the season, it was electric each game there at Citi Field, and the excitement was palpable. When you were in the process of interviewing and getting ready to become a manager, you know, obviously you spent a lot of time in baseball, in Major League Baseball as a pitching coach. Was that your ultimate goal to become a manager, or was it something where you had obviously that great success and you worked for Terry Francona, who was a tremendous advocate of yours? What were your thoughts while you were a pitching coach? Was it like, you know what, I want to move up, or was it something that just kind of happened organically?
Yeah, I love being a pitching coach, but I first and foremost love leadership, right? That is something I'm very passionate about. I study about it. I read about it as much as I can. And I always wanted to be in a leadership role of some sort. And, you know, when you're a pitching coach, you're leading 12 pitchers. When you're a manager, you're leading basically the you know, organization from on down from the GM. So, you know, that is a goal I had for sure even early on. You know, I obviously knew going in there wasn't many pitching guys to become managers in the history of baseball. But, you know, it was a lofty goal, but it was something that I really wanted to do. And I think my last 2 years as being a pitching coach in Cleveland, I really started to consider it being a huge possibility. So I studied even more, you know, about all facets of the game and started to really research the analytics and kind of dive deep into that type stuff. So, you know, it's something that I had a lot of passion for leadership, and it was something that just kind of, you know, transpired over some pretty quality seasons there in Cleveland, leading 12 pitchers.
So, Mickey, here in New York, the Mets have now gone on a streak of losing 7 in a row, including like 11 of 12. And, you know, at some point they were 20-some-odd games over 500. And things have now come down where they're 5.5 games behind the Phillies. You know, in 2018, the Mets had gone on in July, a 9-game losing streak. How do you feel you handled that in that time? And what is a manager's role in that situation when the team goes into a spell where it's hard to get out of?
Yeah, so with that, you know, and I'm not sure a lot of people would agree in New York, but you have to stay positive, right? You You have to sit up there in front of the media, pick out the good things that are going on, because baseball is a game of streaks. In 2017, when I was with the Cleveland Indians, we won 22 games in a row.
That was unbelievable.
I think the rest of the season, we were two games below 500. Right? So without that 22-game winning streak or whatever it was, or however many games above 500 were, we weren't going to be there, right? So baseball's a game of streaks. You have to understand that you might lose 7 or 9 or 11 of 12 at some point. But, hey, the Mets are still in it, and hopefully the manager's in there saying the same thing. Hey, we're still in it, guys. I know this is a tough stretch. Let's keep our heads up. We have the players to be able to do this. You know, we got to obviously stay healthy and throw strikes. You know, I think one of the things that might have haunted the Mets to this point is they're based on balls. They walk a lot of guys and they don't strike a lot of guys out. It's kind of mediocre, kind of across the board when you're looking at their numbers, you know, as far as batting average, run scored. They're just, you know, they kind of hang around the middle of the pack. But where they're really poor at, I think they're 27th in baseball, is walking guys. And then they're not striking a ton of guys out. You know, if you're going to be 27th in walks, you better be first or second or third in strikeouts to kind of counteract that. So, you know, they haven't given up a ton of runs. Their ERA is not that high. Their on-base percentage and stuff is just mediocre. The one thing I did look into, their batting, you know, they're very unlucky at the plate. I think that, their hard hit balls are there. Their batting average on balls in play is very low. I think they're down maybe 27th or something, hitting about 275. And that usually kind of works its way up to the 300 mark. And if that happens, you know, some of those, you know, games kind of turn the other way. But, you know, it's getting late in the season, so you don't know that it's necessarily going to turn around at this point. But the manager's got to be positive. You know, the players have to see a manager that's positive and not panicking. Because if the manager panics, then the players are going to panic. You know, you're the leader out there. You know, and no matter how hard it is for maybe fans or somebody else to understand the positivity part when things are going bad, you have to keep on doing it. You know, I think that's one thing I like about Aaron Boone over there with the Yankees. Obviously, things aren't going their way this year. But in the past, he's always kept, pretty upbeat locker room, and it seems to work out pretty good for him. I know they haven't won a World Series, which is everybody's goal, but, that is not an easy task for sure.
Yeah, and especially with the Yankee organization, any season that doesn't end in a World Series, it's
a failure, right? Yeah.
which exactly. Is such a shame. Yeah. I wanted to ask you, Mickey, behind the scenes, you know, in the situations you're talking about, obviously being positive is, as you said, it's just paramount. And, you know, fans and media maybe don't understand that because it's a team dynamic. But as a human being, as the leader of the team, when you're going through those kind of down times, is it something in professional sports in a major league clubhouse where if a guy is maybe dogging it a little bit or is just kind of down, is it something where you can pull him aside and kind of, you know, get into him a little bit? Or is that just overrated and kind of like, you know, coach speak of people who aren't really in the game on the professional level?
Oh, no. I think that definitely has to be there, right? Yeah. You have to have the ability to pull a guy in and tell him to get after it. You know, obviously that's a manager's job on a good team.
Yeah.
Great, and I'm sure you guys have heard this quote before, right? Good teams, the coaches lead. Great teams and championship teams, the players lead.
Yeah.
So ideally, you have a player in that clubhouse like a David Wright or somebody who kind of steps in and kind of does that for you, because every time, 100% of the time, the players are going to respond better to their peers. You know, I had to get in some guys' asses when I was there, and, you know, sometimes it doesn't end up great. They go in, they complain that I yelled at them or something to other players, and then it just doesn't turn out great.
Yeah.
But when you got the team and the players doing that in the locker room and kind of managing that locker room and making sure everybody's hustling and doing the things they can, then that's where you become that championship caliber team. And that's why it's so important when you're building a team to make sure you get the right players. And I thought we had that, you know, in, with the Mets when I was there. And I thought we were on our way. You know, we went from, what, 70 wins the year before I got there to 77 to 86. And I could feel the young, you know, Alonzo's and McNeil starting to really mesh. And I was really looking forward to that third year to see if we could do something special. Unfortunately, it wasn't in the cards for me, but, you know, I really enjoyed my time there as a leader in that clubhouse.
Yeah, that brings up another great point. That seems to be such a double-edged sword with New York. You know, it's great to be a manager. It's great, you know, on the biggest stage. You know, if you're doing great, you're a hero. If you're treading water, yeah, unfortunately, you just don't get the leash that I'm sure, you know, that resume in practically any other baseball town, you're by far coming back, and that's a tough thing to deal with. Those 2 years, though, you brought up a couple of names. Was there someone developing? I know you said Alonzo and McNeil, but was there someone in the clubhouse that you could kind of count on at that time who was, you know, a solid presence? Or was it just such a young group that you really needed as the manager to continue to develop those guys in the leadership?
You know, I think we had some really great guys on that team. We had, you know, the Todd Frazier's and guys like that were a little bit older, the Jay Bruce's. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the problem with that is at this stage in their career, it was maybe a little bit more difficult to do what we're talking about. You really want, you know, a Francisco Lindor in your locker room. That guy is one of the best guys I've ever been around. When he was a rookie, he was leading our team in Cleveland. So, you know, we really need someone of that caliber, one of your better players to be able to step up. You know, you had David Wright when things were going well, when Terry was there. I got to see quite a bit of David around the clubhouse, but he wasn't playing. So it was kind of hard for him to really step into that role and embrace it like he had in the past. So you really, you know, you really need one of your better performers to be out there and be able to lead, in my opinion.
Real quick, just explain having Jacob DeGrom go out on the mound every fifth day for you. What was it like to just, I don't know how much you coached him up or, you know, the pitching staff did, but what was it like to have him on your staff?
I mean, I don't think anybody needs to coach Jacob DeGrom. That guy is just an unbelievable talent when he comes onto the mound, and really just an unbelievable athlete all around. You know, you watch him hit, you watch him out there running around fielding ground balls before the game. The guy's an incredible athlete, and to be able to watch him pitch. You know, I was there for Corey Kluber's two Cy Youngs. Mm-hmm. I was there for Jacob DeGrom's two Cy Youngs, mm-hmm. and it's pretty amazing. You know, it was nerve-wracking for me as a manager. The one I'll never forget was we were in Philly, and Jacob, in the middle of his Cy Young run, threw 44 pitches in the first inning and didn't give up a run.
Wow.
I've never even heard of anything like that. And I was like, oh, great. Yeah, he does this. The best pitcher on the planet does this when I'm managing him, and I got to make the decision whether or not to send him back out. But I think we made the right decision. We pulled him out of the game, after, you know, one inning, and he still ended up winning a Cy Young.
Yeah.
So, I was worried about that one thing, really. But, when it comes down to it, no matter what accolades are on the line, you have to take care of guys' health, or then your team has no chance moving forward. So we took him out, and, he ended up finishing with a Cy Young, and it was awesome. But that guy is electric. I mean, I can't even. I think that, and I have this theory, and I might be totally wrong, but I really and truly think this. The reason we couldn't score runs for Jacob DeGrom is because all of our hitters are out in the field watching Jacob DeGrom
in awe.
Make hitting look like the most difficult thing in the world, which it is.
Yeah.
But he makes it look almost impossible, and I think that got in our guys' heads.
Yeah,
you know, that and you know, and putting pressure on themselves to go out there and score runs for him because they wanted him to win every game.
Yeah, it didn't get
he was insane.
Yeah,
it was awesome,
and it was tough to get him run support then. But so if that was kind of like the easiest part of your job, what was like the toughest situation that you've had to deal with as a manager in New York?
You know, I think that just the daily grind of just nonstop people visiting, right? You always have people in your office, celebrities coming on the field. You're having to kind of, you know, make the rounds and be introduced to a tons of people while still trying to pay attention to the players at times the best you can. That was really the biggest challenge for me. You know, I came from Cleveland where we had two beat writers. There was no celebrities coming in. So I got to observe Tito kind of just make his way around the clubhouse casually and have, you know, these one-on-one meetings and stuff. And when I got to New York, I was like, oh, holy crap, when am I going to meet with guys? You know, when am I going to be able to pay attention to some of the guys on the team or talk to the coaching staff? You know, I was there at 11 a.m. every day trying to get a workout in, and then it would start, and it was nonstop until batting practice. When I threw the first group of BP, that was really my first break. Wow. And then by that time, you're kind of going into, you know, second, third, fourth groups of BP, and guys are getting ready for the game. So that's my biggest challenge, is just managing when could I really pay attention to the players like I'd like to. And, you know, that's just a different dynamic in New York.
Mike and I aside, do you feel like the New York media gave you too tough of a time during certain situations?
Yeah, you know what? I mean, just no, you know, I kind of look at managing this way. Like, I've been doing a podcast a little bit, with some people. And, you know, they ask questions about managers' decisions and stuff. And the one thing I'll always say is I'll never criticize a manager, because the manager is the only one that knows all of the information. If the guy's hurting, if the guy, you know, didn't sleep last night for some reason, and all of these things, a manager can't stand up in front of the sports reporters and the fans
no.
and talk about.
No.
Right? You have to take care of the organization and the players that are in that clubhouse. So I think that was a challenge as well, is, you know, you really can't give all the information. So to really give the sports writers what they deserve, as much of the truth as you possibly can without it being a, you know, tactical disadvantage when you're going to play, you know, the Tampa Bay Rays next week. You can't reveal that Jacob DeGrom has a little bit of a, you know, sore thumb or whatever when he's pitching. So, you know, that kind of made it difficult. And I can understand, you know, the dynamic in New York where the fans, they want what they want, right? And they don't want to sit there and read about Kumbaya every day, because that's not reality, yeah. Right? The fans, the baseball is for the fans, and I think the sports writers in New York give them what they want to hear, and that's totally fine by me. So, I didn't feel, you know, that it was unfair or anything. Obviously, it was a challenge at times to read some of the stuff I did, but that's part of the game there in New York, and I really thoroughly enjoyed it. Like I said, baseball, playoff atmosphere every night, I'll take it 162 times a year.
Well, we appreciate your candor, because that's something that very often, you know, you don't hear, and it's a real great fact of life that you're protecting your team, you're managing your group, and you're trying to give, you know, I don't want to say sound bites, but you're trying to give the reporters their due and give them their time, and it's got to be a very, very, you know, tough tightrope to maneuver. Before we let you go, just wanted to check in now in 2025. You know, you said you're doing some pitching work. Are you looking to get back into managing, coaching on a professional level? Where, you know, where do you stand right now, and what are your immediate goals?
Yeah, you know, I just bought a ranch, a 50-acre ranch here in North Mississippi, just south of Memphis. So I bought chickens and ducks the other day, and you know, try to raise some cattle over here. So I'm doing that right now. But there's no doubt I'd love to get back at the professional ranch, the coaching college. So if that opportunity arises, I would definitely take it. I miss the game. I miss professional baseball. I miss that level of competitiveness that you see on a nightly basis. I miss the pressure. So you know, I would love to obviously get back in the game. I've been eligible for a few years now. I haven't really reached out to anybody. You know, if somebody wants me, I'm sure they'll reach out someday, and I will gladly consider it.
Well, you certainly proved you can do it, and you did have, you know, you improved each year in New York, and we hope you get the chance to do that again. We can't thank you enough for all your time this evening. We're rooting for you as well, and you know, hopefully we can have you back on again in the future. But in the short term, thank you for your insights, and you know, it really gives us an extra boost here in looking at two New York teams that are struggling a little bit. But you know, we can talk about it a little differently, and I know Chris feels the same way.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you guys having me. I'd love to get back on, and hopefully, you know, both New York teams can go on a 9-0, 10-0 run here and get back into the thick of things, because you need that playoff baseball in New York every year, that's for sure.
All right. Well, thank you. As a member of the Seven Lion Army, we really appreciate all the work you put into the time in New York.
Appreciate it, fellas. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. All right. Mickey Callaway, former New York Met manager. Had great success in Cleveland, and we're hoping for good things for him in the future. We're going to take a quick break and then get back a little more baseball talk here on WGBB Sports Talk New York.
Listening to Sports Talk New York. Tune in every Sunday night at 8 p.m. on Long Island's WGBB. Broadcasting on 95.9 FM and 1240 AM. Or listen live online at WGBBRadio.com. Stay connected to Sports Talk New York on WGBB by following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at WGBB Sports Talk. You're listening to Sports Talk New York on Long Island's WGBB. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to the second half of WGBB Sports Talk New York, 95.9, 1240 a.m. on your dial. Number's 516-623-1240 if you'd like to call in and join us. Again, that's 516-623-1240. Talk a little baseball. We can, if you have any questions about Mickey Callaway and his great interview we just had with him. Unfortunately, we had a little bit of a technical issue with his phone, but we were able to get through it. And, you know, again, he gave us some great insights on what it's like managing in New York. I think we could have probably, you know, done another half hour with him, and I'm hoping to do that on a little clearer signal next time, because besides the Mets, you know, Cap, as we were talking off air, he had some interesting personalities that he managed and worked with.
Yeah, I mean, he had to deal with a lot of, you know, shots here in New York, people in Cleveland, and, you know, for people who might have looked up some of his past, he had to take some time away from baseball for some penalties that he, you know, unfortunately put on himself.
Yeah, and we didn't, obviously we weren't going to delve into that, but he admitted that. You know, I think also, here's a guy, grew up in Tennessee, you know, went to school in Mississippi, then gets into professional baseball. Now he's in Cleveland, which is no small potatoes market, but it's Cleveland, it's not. And then, boom, his first real managerial job in professional baseball is in New York.
It's different.
Yeah, and I thought, you know, again, I thought he did real well. I mean, I don't know what else was going on behind the scenes at that time, but he did. You know, he had that. Maybe he was a victim, unfortunately, of that great start, because they did start out so well. Then they hit the skids, and that first year was not what he was looking for. Second year better, but you know, the Met ownership and everything.
It was
at that
somewhat
time,
trying to change. You got to also remember they brought in Brody Van Wagenen to take over for Sandy Alderson, who had stepped away. So you had a guy who was Jacob DeGrom's agent is now your boss.
Yes.
So you're dealing with definitely a different situation. And, you know, I think that kind of plays part of it, is now you have a guy above you who you just, it's a different person than it was the first year. And, you know, you have guys, like Marcus Stroman on your roster, guys like, you know, bringing in Edwin Diaz and Robinson Cano and, you know, having to get rid of Matt Harvey halfway through the season because some of the mistakes he made. It's like, you know, there was some behind-the-scenes stuff that we didn't talk about that were not easy to deal with. David Wright had to retire in one of his seasons. Yeah.
And it seems like he would definitely be willing to get into that. It's a sticky wicket because he's trying to get back into baseball. You know, not that we lob softball questions at him tonight, but I would like to dive into a little bit of that. But for me, as someone who just coaches sports and as a teacher, it's fascinating when you hear guys like him talk about their, you know, leadership and being positive all the time and then getting in someone's butt. And it's just, I could sit and talk to guys like that for hours, just picking their brain what it's like. And, it's just, you know, what a privilege it must be to manage on that level, but the heartache you go through.
As a pitching coach, excellent. I just think he ran into a tough time in New York and wasn't able to get himself out of that. Another guy who I'd love to talk to about stuff like this, people who go through the rankings like you and I, Mike, like a Nate Oates at Alabama basketball, a guy who was a high school math teacher, then went to the University of Buffalo and eventually winds up at Alabama. Like, this is a guy who went through the grind just to get where he was, and he was coaching, you know, high school basketball and coaching math a few years before that. So those are the situations where it's like, wow, like the only difference between him and us is he has to do it on a bigger spotlight. But these guys come and they talk and they say, hey, listen, you know, my job is to take all of the tough stuff and not really talk about it. But he was given a tough time by some of the media, and he had to go on the air and kind of, you know, take some of that stuff and put it down. But you know, where we are with the Mets right now, Mike,
it's tough. Well,
every day, you know, let's start. Like, last week, they were not doing well to begin with. It's been tough. I think the Mets and the Yankees have the third and fourth worst record since June 13th.
Correct.
Somewhere around, like, 20 and 30 and you know, 20 and 32, something like that, between the two of them. Things weren't going well. And people might say today or last night or whatever was rock bottom. But being at that game last Wednesday and them not having a hit in the ninth inning, that was pretty bad.
It was. You know, Chris and I went to the game, and it was an afternoon game. Very, you know, beautiful day. Good size crowd because obviously you have the camps there. But there was, it was a weird feeling though. I mean, going to baseball games, we're going to Met games, you know, for 40 plus years. It just walking around the stadium, I didn't feel like I was even at a major league game. It was weird.
Yeah, it was kind of a little relaxed, and you can hear people on the way and say, "Oh, we're gonna win today. We're gonna win today."
Yeah.
And listen, I don't like to call myself pessimistic. I try to say I'm somewhat of a down realist.
You're a realist.
You know, I see what's going on, and I follow the pattern. And I'm not a person that says, "Oh, because we've lost four in a row, we're gonna win the fifth." For me, it's we have to find a way to get out of this rut, or else it's gonna continue.
Yes.
And it's just gonna keep going. And it started with the first play of the game, knocking the glove off of the pitcher.
Mm-hmm.
He hustles after the ball, probably something one of the Mets pitchers wouldn't have done.
No, they would have waited.
Throws the first and gets the guy out.
Yeah.
Okay? Works his way through that inning and, you know, a couple of walks here or there.
Yeah, a couple of hiccups later on.
But, Mike, that game went on and on.
Yeah.
And what were you and I talking about?
Ugh.
The guy's got a no-hitter.
A no-hitter, absolutely, yes.
You get, and you start counting.
And even early, I think, inning or so, we're like, hey, you know, fans.
It became quicker innings.
Yes.
Because remember that first inning was like 33 pitches.
I mean, we walked around. We had a couple of young kids with us and families, and we did a quick walk. And before you know it was like the sixth inning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a couple of runs for the other team. And now you're counting down their outs, 15, 12, 9, 6. And now you're getting a 6, and you had two different sets of people at the game, right?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
So what was it, Mike? What were two sets of people?
You had a lot of Cleveland fans there.
Correct. You had people there. You know, we were sitting near the Cleveland dugout.
But then you had a lot of Met fans who were kind of rooting for a no-hitter.
So you had the Met fans rooting for the no-hitter, and then you had the other people who were just dying to break it up.
Right. Yeah.
And listen, if you've gotten that far and your team's down 4-0, I'd love to see history.
Of course.
And
not to interrupt you, but I mean, seriously, and it's not as if this team has been playing a certain way to where you're like, you know what, They're sharp. They're just having a down moment. They're going to continue to fight. It was not as if I felt that was going against my Met fandom saying, I literally thought they got no shot to win this game.
Nothing.
So why not see some history?
Yeah, it wasn't like it was 1-0.
No.
You know? And then, like, you know, you could see a guy come up to the plate, and it was almost like, you know, someone was thinking early in the game, you know, not the ninth inning, of possibly laying down a bunt.
Right.
And it was like, oh, boy, you can't do that. And it just got to that last inning, and I was rooting for it. And you know, I think you had said to me, you thought maybe it would come up to Alonso hitting the game.
I didn't want to say anything.
Yeah,
I shot you a text. I said they're going to get two out, and then Pete's going to hit a home run. It wound up being one out and right. Soto. But
so Soto hits the home run.
All right, but I want to
go ahead.
So I'd like to rewind just a second with that, and this is something a guy like Mickey Callaway, I would have loved to ask them, and maybe next time I will. I kind of alluded to it about getting into guys. So, all right, Soto is Soto. One, he's got this incredible contract, whatever else, but he's the highest paid player.
Yeah.
Now, he might not be the greatest leader. Doesn't seem that way. He probably didn't sign up for that. And maybe his contract 10 years from now will be a bargain. But you cannot have that type of guy. And let's just take his name out. Let's just call him Juan Smith.
Yeah.
All right. Who grounds out, I mean, it's solid, grounds out, and just jogs to first base.
Oh.
I mean, listen, I get it. You're out. You're 99 times out of 100, there's not going to be an error. But, I mean, I ran to the bathroom faster than he ran to first base.
Yeah.
I mean, and now we're talking about a team with no life. There you go.
Yeah. And I understand at times, you know, it's 7-0 in the ninth inning, a ground ball to third.
Yeah.
I don't want him pulling a handy doing that.
Of course. But, I mean, mid-fifth,
yep.
He's just chilling going down that. So when we talk about the difference of a team last year that had Spunk, the oh, my God, the grimace, like, now, can you blame it on one guy? No, you can't blame it on one guy. But, man, there's a lot to do with it when you add a talent like that, but they bring you nothing in terms of the intangibles of the game.
So status veteran for the Mets, 60. Again, this is pretty much what they're making this year. Juan Soto, $61 million. Huh. Francisco Lindor, $34 million. Okay. Alonso, $30. Edwin Diaz, $21. Starlin Marte, $20. Nimmo, $20. Sean Manaea, 20. Frankie Montas, 17. Okay, and we can get
wait,
if you'd like.
Frankie Montas, 17.
Yeah, we got 2 years plus a third.
Whoa.
Yeah, possible. All
oh,
right.
Far.
Jeff McNeil, 15. Kodai Senga, 15. Clay Holmes, 13. Those are just some veterans that are all making double-digit $1 million. You know, this team is not a team that's out there trying to make the playoffs because they have guys who are making $2 to $3 million. No, Ronnie Mauricio is making $766,000. Fine. You're going to throw Vientos and Beatty and Alvarez. They're all making $700,000. Okay?
Yeah.
But the rest of these guys are making major money. And I don't know if anybody's getting on them for the way that they're playing. And I know that in years past, other managers may have dealt with this. So
we're going to
go back to, you know, a couple of years back when, after a 9-0 loss to the Arizona Diamondbacks, Terry Collins came out and said this.
Play the game correctly. And we're all responsible, every single one of us. The coaches, me, the player, we're all in this together. There's no one guy to blame. There's no one guy to point a finger at. I don't do that. I have never done that. Never. I am a team guy. I believe in team, just as you guys do. You write a bad story, it's about the paper. It's about where you came from. Everybody's in it. And I believe that. Today's game, it's going to happen again. But I know one thing. Starting tomorrow, we're back fresh. Starting tomorrow, we're going to get after it here. And those who don't want to get after it, I will find somebody else who does. Because in Las Vegas, there's a whole clubhouse full of guys who want to sit in this room. And I'll find them. That's all I got to say. I'm done.
Now, that's leadership.
Does Carlos Mendoza need to do something like that?
Yes.
Or is it Mickey Callaway saying, you got to stay positive, you got to stay positive?
And that's what I was...
He didn't name one name.
No, he didn't.
He did not name one person there.
But he showed that he cares in that clip, and that he's as passionate. Now, I think that's a masterclass right there on being the leader, taking the hits, not naming guys, but saying, "Hey, look, you know, I'm
responsible."
Yes,
that's what he
Buck
starts
stops
with
me.
Yes,
yeah, and tomorrow we're going to come out and play hard, and if you don't, you know, hit the road. I don't know Carlos Mendoza. I've never met the man. You know, he's had some interesting streaks as a manager, very streaky. You don't get this job, and you're not a Yankee bench coach if you don't know the game well. I'm rooting for him. I hope he does well. But I think the time comes. You don't even have to be that passionate. Just come out and say, hey, look, I realize that we stink and that, you know, we're going to find a way. No, get a little zip under you.
Yeah. It's hard to describe. Tough, frustrating, but we've got to turn the page.
Oh, gosh.
There wasn't a good showing, and they pretty much outplayed us. You know? And
when outplayed you?
When we ask about Frankie Montas, we haven't made a decision yet. As of now, we think.
And I get now, like, he's hamstrung with
that. You have to step up at some point and say, this way of losing, a different way every night, it's got to stop.
Right.
And the guys in the clubhouse need to go out and make a stand. Because we don't have one guy since June that has a above 700 OPS. League averages around, good guys are around 800.
Yeah.
Not one of these guys is doing something to put themselves on base or to score somebody else.
And they're three quote-unquote all-stars on this team.
And you put Juan Soto in a big situation, not happening.
No.
22 out of his 28 home runs, solo.
He's Juan Solo.
It's Juan Solo. All right, well, we're going to welcome in here our Mets helper here from the Mets Love Podcast. James Schiano is going to join us. And if you want to get any of your frustration out, you now have the mic, James.
James, help us, please.
What's up, guys? When I caught on here, you were talking about the clip. Did Mendoza say something post-game that I might have missed about
No, he didn't.
Like that's the struggle.
No,
that's the point.
We played the Terry Collins after the 9-0 loss, where I'll go down to Vegas type clip.
Yeah, we so podcast, our Twitter account, we have like a yearly ritual. We post that every single year with the exact same caption. And Mark and I have a contest with each other to see how many impressions that clip gets year over year. Every single year, the Mets fans are like, this is exactly what we want.
Yeah. Now, all he said today was, we're very frustrated, but we've got to keep going. Nobody said it was going to be easy. Those quotes come every day from Carlos Mendoza.
Yeah. I mean, the one thing about the fact that there's no fire now, it does give me a little bit more confidence that he's never a fire guy, so it'd be even crazier if, especially to the media, if suddenly the fire came out. I'm just worried about whether or not, and we can't know this, and well, I guess we'll know it tomorrow when the writers put some articles out, but about fire that could be inside the clubhouse. Like, I think no matter what, like, I'm fine with these guys not blowing up on the media, because they've never been anything besides, like, cordial with the media, like, friendly, nice. I think, like, Mendoza and, like, Stearns especially, like, they have their own little, like, rapport with the media. There just needs to be some rapport of someone inside that room saying or doing something, because it's like, it has to be, whether it be Mendoza or Lindor, Alonso, Nimmo, so, and someone has to just open their mouth and be like, we have to get some of these things out in the air right now, because there's no cohesion with this roster. It's just completely empty on the field. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, and before we get into numbers, just the team in general, you know, a lot of people say, oh, it's rock bottom, and it just happens a different way every time. Is this just a matter of things kind of going down a bad path and maybe things change at some point? Or is there major – because I'm not a big, you know – Juan Soto's not allowed to have a laugh in the dugout with Tyrone Taylor. To see them smile while the Mets are on a 7-game losing streak is bad. I'm not for that. You know, it's okay to still be a human being. But is it at the point where it's just so bad it's never going to turn around again? Or do you think that, you know, it's just the law of averages?
Yeah, I mean, it feels like a little bit of both, right? Like, it's kind of fair to think it would be both. I think the Mets have had some, in terms of, like, the expectations of the players, the players on this team, definitely a lot of bad results, things that they were like, this is turning out worse than we thought it was going to. And then also, just a few injuries. Every team has injuries. Every team has guys that don't, you know, play up to their standards in a particular year. But it's just the fact that, like you guys said right before I got on, every single guy is having one of their worst stretches of the season at the same time. But it happens to be 2 months. So it's like, it's not really the same time. It's more just like, there's like a group coldness. It's, I don't know. It's hard. I mean, you guys watch it every day. It's hard to explain. Like, you watch a baseball team lose confidence. You can't really describe it, but you can see it very clearly. And, like, visibly, that's what this weekend felt like.
I'm not a make change for change sake guy. It's just not in my nature as well. And, you know, I I don't like seeing people fired or whatever else. But do you think that there's just got to be something, some kind of shakeup? You know, new hitting coach. I don't say fire the manager, but just there's got to be something that A, doesn't look desperate, but B, maybe changes something here a little bit because it is desperation time.
I mean, probably any move you make in August, firing a coach probably does look desperate, but also that doesn't really, I don't know, sometimes, I don't think these guys care so much about the optics at this point and where this organization is. Maybe like the past versions of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think right now they're very consistent to one, stay the course, but also two, definitely realize that there needs to just be a moment. There needs to be something that galvanizes these guys. Like the way it's kind of funny looking back, but this team kind of looked like this for a month and a half, 2 months last season. And all of a sudden, Jorge Lopez throws, like, one of the greatest tantrums I've ever seen in a baseball field. All of a sudden, like, it's just like, whoa. Like, you just have to – there needs to be, like, a runway for these guys to let some things out. It seems like there's just something that's just, like, a blockade, like a mental blockade team-wise. I don't know. It's just hard to even explain when you watch it every day.
Yep. 516-623-1240. We're talking with James Schiano of the Mets Up Podcast. James, you know, getting thrown out at home plate the other night, obviously, we talk about, you know, we could have put Tyrone Taylor in. He, you know, has – the decisions that Mendoza has made, whether it be who to put in the game, who to take out of the game, who to pinch run, you know, has that been a little too much for him lately? Do you think that it's gotten to be a little too much? Because he seems to have an answer each time, but it seems to me to be the wrong answer.
The Friday game was the first time where I was like, oh, man, like this is actually the kind of call that is inexcusably bad. At least every manager makes crappy bullpen decisions. Like, that's just going to happen across the league no matter what. Like, the pinch hit, pinch run decisions, like, I mean, just the pinch hit decisions, like, I understand the gut that Mendoza uses for that, and, like, he used it well last year, so it's like, it worked one year, it didn't work the other year, okay. The no pinch run is, like, that's, like, kind of, I'm asleep moment, because it's very obvious that the guy you have on the bench is faster than Starling Marte. Marte's, like, fiscally one of the slowest players in baseball this year, and now, as the tying run, you just leave him out. Like, it's just, that seemed like such a layup, such an obvious, like, reflex, instinct that wasn't taken, which didn't question Carlos Mendoza, but it was the first time where I thought, like, oh, that was a, there's no explanation behind this one.
What are the bench coaches, like, what's going on?
That's a good question, right?
Yeah.
John Gibbons is the bench coach.
John Gibbons, yeah. I mean, the guy was a player, spits nails. I mean, he's not a quiet guy. That's not why he's there. I mean, they're not having this conversation. It's unbelievable.
Like, even in the flow of that game, and after a couple of days before it, I mean, at least watching it, I felt shocked that hit went in the gap from Starling Marte. So I understand maybe, like, again, like, being asleep. If there's ever a moment to be asleep, like, I felt like I was sleeping for most of that game. So that's kind of what it felt like to me for a degree. Where I was just like, can't believe it. It's like, oh, now he's throwing out. Like, wait a second, you should have pinch ran. It's like, I don't know. It was a sleepy moment, but
well,
being asleep after those two games, like, I was asleep.
Any coach, basketball, baseball, football, whatever it is, assistant coaches' jobs are to be thinking ahead for the manager. And I'll tell you, if I mean, Chris, he can tell you what was his answer as to why he didn't. He I mean, I know he said something about that. Marte's
he never
faster.
Thought about it.
I think Marte's a good runner.
Yeah, Marte.
Untrue. Marte definitely. In that play, Marte did everything.
The guy's had knee problems. Yeah. What are you kidding?
Yeah, no, of course. Yeah. No, the Tyrone Taylor's the Flash. Like, he's.
Yeah, I mean, why else have him on the team?
Why else is he?
Yeah, I mean, he's.
Well, I think we're now
it's even more upsetting because then you look back at Tuesday, Monday, whatever day the first game was against the Guardians, and Tyrone Taylor is the pinch
runner. He was in there. And then we don't send him.
Where it's like, how did we get both of these wrong? Like, in the aggregate,
it is
like,
a comedy. 50-50
things. Like, you got to get one, you don't get the other one. Then you win one of those games. Like, every game is Brewer series.
And I know he's got to back
his. If you make half the right plays, you sweep the series.
Yeah, and
like,
I know he's
such a winnable series. Just do everything wrong.
He's got to back his coaches up, so he's going to say 100% he would have been out of the plate, or he made the right decision in not sending him. If they send him, this losing streak number one is not seven games, but I think that makes a huge difference in that series against the Guardians. Changes. You know, the way things are flowing for the Mets, and I think, you know, at this point, they're just fishing to see offensively who they're going to put up there. But my question to you is, we're at like 53, 54 straight games without getting two different pitchers to go six-plus innings in a start. You know, what's the next? Like, how do we get guys to be on this team? Maybe we just don't have that this year. You know, Shomanai is not ready. He hits a wall every time. He's not ready for that. Kodai Senga's not ready for that. David Peterson is the one guy. Frankie Montas doesn't even start for us anymore. And, you know, we're going to be bringing back Paul Blackburn, who they haven't even given him an idea of what he's doing. So what is the next step, and how do you get these guys to put out more than four innings?
I think that is slightly an unsolvable problem at this point in the season. It's just you kind of got – that's what we got, like, talked about at the beginning here, and I was like, a lot of it's bad performance, a lot of it's bad luck. Like, you shoot for – like half of these guys being able to do that by this time of year, the way they went into the season. The fact that you can't get that from either Minaya or Senga, the guys who are kind of presumed to be the top two guys in the staff. They both got hurt. They both dealt with some stuff, but it's just like still, it's like a big part of the team was predicated on at least one of those guys doing something like that. And the fact that it's neither of them, it's like you, unless they want to bring up one of these kids, which it seems like they might based on all the shuffling they did today, with Joe and Tom going to AAA, Robbie Ayala, double A guys going to AAA. But
oh, I didn't even see that.
Really, yeah, they put up Tong's up, Ewing's up, Clifford's up, and then there was a couple others. The big they did like a big up, a big double up from
so then maybe
the Binghamton, the Binghamton, yeah. Syracuse. That seems like to bring Joe and Tong to that rotation. Clearly, someone's going to leave that rotation. It's kind of the idea, but it's also you can't really expect one of those guys to come up and do that this year either.
No,
like you have to bring those guys up in. Oh, whoa, wow! Walk on the street here. Holy crap!
You're right.
Yeah, I got a motorcycle right in front of me.
Oh, but, my goodness.
No, I'm sorry. He was blaring his thing like a jerk. But
okay.
You had to build those guys up slowly over the last 2 months if you wanted them to do in the stretch run. Now they're kind of close to their own innings limits. They've been pitching with a six-man rotation the whole year in AAA. You can't really expect more than like what Frankie Montas is doing right now from one of those guys. And you give them a little bit. They bite that off. They can chew it. Then you can give them more. It's like that's just, I don't know. It seemed like such an easy answer in June to let one of those guys be like this kind of bulk sponge kind of guy. Like we saw D.L. Hall do today for the Brewers on Sunday. Try neither of them there. It's kind of like, oh, that's a miss.
Well, I think, you know, right now it's the bats. I mean, who's the biggest disappointment for the Mets at the plate? Is it Lindor?
It's definitely Lindor. I feel like it's not even close, right?
I just think it's a bad season.
Like, it's objectively a bad season from a guy that came in second place National League MVP last year.
Yeah, but I just
like,
think
people talk about the regression. It's like that's a big part of this team's regression this year.
The hard part is, you know, as a manager, he tries to leave him up in the top of the lineup, but he's killing him. But the other guy that's absolutely destroying them is Brandon Nimmo. You got your three-hitter bunting today because he's striking out 50% of the time. You know, there's just too many holes in the lineup, and I think you got to try to just put your best players in the top five, whoever it is.
Who's that? Yeah, who do you think that is then?
I mean,
what do you change? No one's hitting up and down the hole. I mean, I Mauricio and Alvarez a little bit more, but like I don't McNeil. I guess
McNeil,
the most consistent. You can make him the two guy again. Maybe I don't know, but it's still just like
They might have to take a grasp and bring up a guy straight from from Double A and Carson Bench. I don't know. They might have to do something crazy because it's not going to be Cedric Mullins.
No, I mean Cedric Mullins is not hitting that poorly. Like in terms of. It's funny, the deadline stuff, it's like, so, you know, hell, they blew the game today, but you go five straight innings against another team's bullpen, you don't score a run. Like, you have to get insurance for the guys. Just, I don't know. It's all going to happen at once if it does happen, because, like, there's no teeny tiny little tweak at this point. They're just kind of broken.
Yep. Hopefully it changes.
Well, you can hear the exasperation in everybody's voice. James Chiano, thanks so much. Hopefully we have you on next time, and it's a little happier conversation.
Yeah, hopefully. Thank you, guys.
All right, absolutely. Thanks to James. Thanks to Mickey Callaway.
Yeah.
And
fun night. Hopefully, change for the Yankees and the Mets, and we can talk about something positive in 2 weeks.
And we will definitely, for you football people out there, NFL and NCAA football coming up, we'll be hitting that soon. Thanks to Brian Graves behind the glass. As always, we'll see you in a couple weeks. Cap, thanks so much, and keep the faith.
All right. Let's go.
Have a good one, everybody.
Management or owners of WGBB.